From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson.
How are you? I'm Ira Melman. On today's program, there are reports of Boko Haram militants crossing into Cameroon and abducting at least 60 people. More when we check International Edition.
Pope Francis delivers Mass for millions of Filipinos gathered under a steady rain in Manila.
Michael Lippin will check the Asian political scene today, focusing on Japan.
We'll have China Focus with Sarah Williams, who looks at how China and the United States are dealing with the need for climate change.
In the American Cafe, stories from the most populous and one of the least populous areas in the United States.
David Byrd will introduce you to the film Testament of Youth.
And Rick Pantaleo pays us a visit with Science World Express.
We'll check business and sports as well. It's all coming up on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America. Thanks for starting off your week with us and Daybreak Asia, our summary of Asia news and events for Monday, January 19th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, Pope Francis was with storm survivors in the central Philippines for a mass at what is considered ground zero for the 2013 super typhoon. From Tacloban, Simone Orendain reports that what else? Stormy weather met Pope Francis and cut short his visit.
With gusts and constant raindrops, Pope Francis told the crowd that he felt he had to be here when he saw footage of the devastation from Super Typhoon Haiyan in November 2013. He was compelled to give them a reminder. He says, Father, you may say to me, Jesus let me down because I lost my house, I lost my family, I lost what I had, I am sick. It's true, you would say that, and I respect that, but there is Jesus on the cross, and from there, he does not let us down. The pontiff said he was at a loss for words over the magnitude of the destruction, but he reassured massgoers that God knew what to say. The 2013 storm hit a region already hobbled by poverty, and church officials say the Pope, a strong advocate of the poor, was determined to get to the day's events despite the bad weather. A tropical storm was expected to make landfall in the vicinity, and many in the raincoat-clad crowd of more than 120,000 waited nearly 24 hours in the downpour for the mass to start. College student Majesty Okan and her friend said it was well worth the wait.
Yeah, a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and we're so blessed that we get to see him and hear his message and be with him.
Oh my God, I see the smile on my face.
The storm cut short the Pope's time, but he was able to get to Palo, a nearby town whose main cathedral is the site of a mass grave for Haiyan victims. He had lunch with typhoon survivors, said a quick hello to religious and clergy at the cathedral, and blessed the Pope Francis Center for the Poor, spending less time at each stop in order to make a 1 p.m. flight back to Manila to beat the storm. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Tacloban.
Big families are not unusual in many parts of the world, but in Thailand, there are new developments in the unusual case of a Japanese businessman who is believed to have fathered at least 15 babies through local surrogate mothers. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok, where the mothers are trying to regain custody of some of those children who were taken by the state.
Thailand's Social Development and Human Security Ministry is denying allegations that some infants in its custody are being treated improperly. That is alleged in a lawsuit filed by nine Thai surrogate mothers who also claim authorities are preventing them from seeing their children. The babies were allegedly fathered by a wealthy 24-year-old Japanese businessman, Mitsutoki Shigeta. The sensational case cast into the spotlight Thailand's shadowy surrogacy industry, which has become a magnet for foreigners seeking to become parents by paying local women to carry and give birth to their children. The director of an Australian nonprofit group, Families Through Surrogacy, Sam Everingham, says it would be appropriate for the children to be removed from government custody.
If father's not appropriate, then being with the surrogate mothers is really, I think, the ideal situation. But we want to stress that this is an unusual case, and parents who've got current arrangements in Thailand shouldn't be concerned about this for their own surrogates.
the Shigeta case, along with the publicity resulting from a surrogate baby with Down syndrome being left behind in Thailand by an Australian couple, prompted the government to crack down on the thriving commercial surrogacy industry last year. The kingdom's legislature, appointed by the military-controlled junta, also is considering a new law that would impose a 10-year prison sentence for anyone convicted of involvement in paid surrogacy. Surrogacy advocates such as Everingham lament how the extreme cases that drew international headlines have led to the new restrictions.
The case of Mr. Shigeta is a pretty appalling example of abuse of international surrogacy by foreigners, and it's one of the reasons which led to the acceleration of the closure of access to surrogacy in Thailand by foreigners.
Thai officials say they are in the process of determining whether the surrogate mothers of the children now in the care of the state are suitable to take custody of them. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
There was a flag raised here in Washington this month that you usually don't see on top of a flagpole, one from Taiwan. And it may have been a calculated move to prove Taiwan's strength to a restless public at home. Taiwan lacks formal relations with the United States, which recognizes China instead. Analysts say Taiwan wants to show it still has tight relations with Washington, a partner many voters on the island prefer over Beijing. Ralph Jennings runs the story at the flagpole for VOA in Taipei.
On New Year's Day, Taiwanese officials in Washington raised their flag for the first time in 36 years. That act at a ceremony attended by 100 people met with anger from China, which forbids its allies, including the United States, from allowing such displays from Taiwan. After the event, U.S. officials said they had no advance knowledge the flag would be raised at a residence formerly used by Taipei's envoys to Washington. While Taipei has downplayed the event and disclosed little about the intentions behind it, political analysts say Taiwan wanted to show off U.S. relations to voters at home who believe their government has grown too close to China. Shane Lee, a political science professor at Chang Rung Christian University in Taiwan, says that while some among the public will find the flag raising imprudent, others will see it as the government expressing its rights overseas. China has claimed sovereignty over Taiwan since the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s and asked Beijing's more than 170 diplomatic allies around the world to bar any acts that indicate statehood for the self-ruled island. Taiwan itself has grown closer to China economically over the past 7 years under the Taipei government of President Ma Ying-jeou. Analysts say the Ma government saw the flag raising as a way to direct attention to Taiwan-U.S. relations. Taiwan Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Anna Gao pointed only to broader Taiwan-U.S. ties when asked at a news conference about the flag-raising incident. She says Taiwan's officials in Taipei and in Washington will continue to carry out close communications with the United States. China's foreign ministry warned the United States to prevent any more such acts. Analysts say the flag raising will not affect relations among Taiwan, China, and the United States in the long term. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Be sure to stop by voanews.com for longer versions of these stories. Many of them have great photos and video. And while you're there, why don't you subscribe to the free Daybreak Asia podcast?
This is our audience feedback section on VOA Global from the Voice of America with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Here's the story. Brazil and the Netherlands have recalled their ambassadors to Indonesia after the Southeast Asian country ignored their pleas for clemency and executed six people, including five foreigners, for drug trafficking. The Attorney General's office says five foreigners and one Indonesian were executed by firing squad just after midnight Sunday morning in the central Java province. Tombstone from USA says Brazil should instead be upset with its citizens for dishonoring their great country by engaging in serious crimes in another country. This is not an endorsement of capital punishment, which I don't believe in. Steve from the United States says it is sad that these drug traffickers were executed, but what Indonesia did was right. It is their law. If you travel to their country or any countries, respect their laws, period. From John. John says, Dutch foreign minister called the executions a cruel and inhuman punishment. What do you call them selling drugs to children or spreading this poison in the society? In Indonesia did the right thing to protect their people. And Chapantico from Costa Rica said, bravo for Indonesia. This is the way to deal with drug trafficking, robbers, and any kind of criminals. And one more, Madrid from Trinidad and Tobago says, I am in total agreement with the decision by the government that should happen in any country.
In Sri Lanka, it's not just the country's powerful president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, who suffered a debacle when he was unexpectedly trounced in last week's elections. His astrologer, who had confidently forecast a certain win for him, also quietly stepped away from the limelight. Tilak from Sri Lanka writes, I've seen many wrong predictions by Sri Lankan astrologers.
This is the Voice of America with Jim Stevens and I'm Ira Melman coming your way on this program. We will have Michael Lippin here with his report on Asia politics, and he will be concentrating on the situation between Japan and China. And that will be followed with China Focus, and Sarah Williams will be talking about how major countries, China and the United States, are dealing with environmental issues. All coming up now.
This is the Asian political scene on VOA Global. I'm Michael Lippin. Japan says it will issue a statement later this year expressing remorse for aggression toward its neighbors in World War II as the region marks the 70th anniversary of the conflict's end. Japanese governments have issued similar statements before. In 1995, then Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama expressed what he called a heartfelt apology for tremendous damage and suffering caused by Japan to the people of many countries. In 1993, Japan's then Chief Cabinet Secretary Yohei Kono also officially apologized for Imperial Japanese troops forcing women from China, Korea, and other nations to work as prostitutes or comfort women. Earlier this month, Japan's current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe pledged to abide by the positions of previous governments, but those past statements have not been enough for China and South Korea, who see Japan under Mr. Abe's rule as trying to downplay responsibility for wartime atrocities committed against them. Tessa Morris Suzuki is a professor of Japanese history at Australian National University. I asked her whether demands from China and South Korea for even stronger Japanese apologies are just an attempt to humiliate Japan.
It's a difficult issue, this, I think. On the one hand, obviously, governments on all sides play politics with this. And the Chinese government and the South Korean government sometimes make highly nationalistic comments that probably unnecessarily offend Japanese opinion. But on the other side, there are reasons, I think, why China and South Korea are concerned about, particularly about the follow-up on the earlier apologies. So the Kono statement of 1993, which was particularly about the comfort women issue, was a very fine apology in a lot of ways. But it promised that the Japanese government would educate the Japanese people and would keep the lessons of history in mind. And the problem is that Japanese governments, successive Japanese governments, really haven't done that. And particularly the Abe government, since it came to power, has in effect, through its inquiry last year and so on, undermined public confidence in the Kono statement and conveyed a message that Japan really didn't have anything very much to apologize for. So that's where those concerns are coming from now, I think.
Could I just follow up on that and ask you, what is it that Shinzo Abe and his government have done in the last 2 years to lend that impression that they don't really believe in the comfort women apology and the other apologies?
Yes, so to an international audience, they have gone on saying that they would maintain the existing apologies, although the word that they use for maintain in Japanese is a rather weak one. It says, you know, we're not going to renounce them, but it doesn't really suggest that they're strongly upholding the apologies. But domestically, a number of statements made by Abe and his cabinet members have suggested that the problem really lay in the process of the Kono Declaration itself. They've made a great deal of publicity about a particular statement that was made by a Japanese soldier in the 1980s and early 90s about the comfort women, which was used by evidence in some reports on the issue and later turned out to be false. And in a sense, through that message, they've conveyed to the Japanese public that really the Japanese military did not forcibly recruit women as comfort women. Now, this is a very misleading message, and it's one that would be refuted by most of the serious historical studies on the issue. So they've been sending that message domestically and then internationally saying, but we still keep on with the existing apologies. And that's produced a lot of cynicism and a lot of concern internationally.
That was Tessa Morris-Suzuki of Australian National University. Thanks for listening. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. U.S. President Barack Obama will deliver his State of the Union address Tuesday night. In his previous State of the Union speech, Mr. Obama highlighted what he called the urgent need to address climate change, a topic that's likely to come up again this year. The world's two biggest polluters, the United States and China, recently announced a landmark deal aimed at breathing new life into global efforts to address climate change, but both face significant challenges. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
In China, where choking smog frequently fills the air, there is little debate about the need to curb emissions. Li Yan heads up Greenpeace's energy and climate change campaign in Beijing.
In China, the awareness of climate change and the consensus that there is, this is a real problem and we need to crack it, is much higher in China than in United States. And then, and it's also in the government, in the leadership, there aren't so many critics, there aren't so many skeptics.
Weaning China off its biggest source of energy, coal, will not be easy. In the deal reached last year, China pledged for the first time to peak its emissions by 2030. Li says there are signs Beijing could move even faster, despite its heavy reliance on cheap fuel.
So it's possible that China would actually have a coal control scheme economy-wide in the next five-year plan, starting next year. And if China does so, then we have a much higher chance of turning the climate curve.
In Washington, Republican lawmakers call the deal a job-killing agreement that threatens middle-class workers. U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell.
The agreement requires the Chinese to do nothing at all for 16 years. While these carbon emission regulations are creating havoc in my state and other states around the country.
China also has economic concerns about the deal. Beijing may have pledged to peak its emissions by 2030, but it is already taking steps to reduce polluting industries at a time when the country's economy is already slowing. But having the world's two biggest emitters in agreement is important for global climate change efforts, says Li Yan. And the hope is that their example, if successful, will help spur other countries to aggressively curb their own emissions. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
China has been battling crippling pollution and smog in recent years. Most experts have blamed car emissions and construction as prime factors for the foul air. But now a government official in a southwestern Chinese city says the major cause is smoked bacon. Rao Bing is the deputy head of Daozhou's Environment Protection Bureau in Sichuan province. The state-run news agency Xinhua quotes him as saying that Daozhou's smog is caused by smoking bacon, which is a traditional means of preserving pork. Pork and sausages are a tradition in Sichuan, and many homes smoke bacon before the Chinese Lunar New Year, which takes place on February 19th. Xinhua reports that Chengguan, or local police, have begun to crack down on meat-smoking sites. However, on Sina Weibo, the campaign faces ridicule. One netizen said that smoking bacon has a long history, but smog does not. Xinhua further quotes volunteers at the Bayou Public Welfare Development Center as saying while smoking meat does contribute to air pollution, it's only by a small amount. The non-governmental center conducted a survey at 12 bacon smoking sites. Other traditional practices in China have been blamed for air pollution, including the burning of straw by farmers. Beijing has also limited industrial production and vehicle use in order to reduce pollution. Last week, air pollution hit a dangerous level in Beijing. On Thursday, the U.S. Embassy said the levels of PM2.5 particulates, the most hazardous to health, rose to 568 micrograms per cubic meter. The World Health Organization recommends a maximum of 25 micrograms a cubic meter. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From VOA Global, this is Asia Business News with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Asian markets finished mixed at the end of last week. The Shanghai Composite gained 1.20%. The Nikkei 225 led the Hang Seng lower. They fell 1.43% and 1.02%, respectively.
China's economic growth may be as high as 7.3% this year. That's partly due to falling commodity prices. The Shangguoqing was quoted as telling a forum that China's consumer price index may rise in 2015 by about 1.6%, saying the sharp decline in prices of commodities, including crude oil, iron ore, and copper, presented a large bonus for the economy. China's annual economic growth likely slowed to 7.2% in the fourth quarter of last year, the weakest since the depths of the global crisis.
Tencent WeBank, China's first so-called internet bank, opened for trial operation Sunday, offering flexible online financial services without setting up any physical branches. WeBank, with a registered capital of 3 billion yuan, about $483 million, was jointly founded by internet giant Tencent, Shenzhen Baiyuan Investment Company, and Shenzhen Lie Group, according to a statement on WeBank's website. According to the Global Times, the WeBank's website did not offer channels for new account applications on the first day of its trial operation. The official Xinhua news agency reported Sunday that during its trial operation, WeBank's business will be limited to opening new accounts for its shareholders and employees, as well as inviting selected customers to experience its services.
And new home sales in 70 major cities recorded the highest month-on-month growth of 2014 in December, boosted by the central bank's interest rate cut. That's a look at business on VOA Global.
This is Today in History. On January 19, 1806, Britain occupied the Cape of Good Hope on the southern coast of Africa. The territory was eventually ceded to the British in the Anglo-Dutch Treaty of 1814. In 1807, Robert E. Lee was born. Lee commanded the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia during the American Civil War. After the defeat of his forces, he surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865, ending the war. In 1809, author Edgar Allan Poe was born in Boston. Poe's writings were noted for their eerie and macabre subject matter. In 1829, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe's Faust Part I was performed publicly for the first time. Faust is a noted literary classic. In 1883, inventor Thomas Edison, looking to build upon the success of his new incandescent light bulb, strung overhead wires from a single generating station to light the village of Roselle, New Jersey. The venture encouraged the widespread installation of electric lighting in the nation. In 1953, the largest TV audience up to that time, more than 70% of viewers, watched an episode of the iconic comedy I Love Lucy, in which Lucille Ball gave birth to a son. The airing was scheduled to coincide with a star's real-life delivery. On this day in 1955, President Dwight Eisenhower became the first U.S. president to hold a news conference to be filmed for television. In 1966, Indira Gandhi was elected by her party to be Prime Minister of India, the first female head of government in India. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
VOA Global from the Voice of America. Time now for International Edition. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. Officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants have abducted at least 60 people in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. Government spokeswoman Issa Chiroma says three people were killed, 80 homes destroyed in Sunday's raid, which targeted villages in Cameroon's far north region. The Reuters news agency cites a senior army officer saying the majority of those kidnapped are children between the ages of 10 and 15. The raid came a day after Chad sent thousands of troops into Cameroon to help fight Boko Haram, which has been seizing territory along the Nigerian-Cameroonian border and recently took control of a military base near the shores of Lake Chad. Cameroon's military says the soldiers will be deployed to the north in the war zone on the Nigerian border. Meanwhile, a suicide bomber has killed at least four and wounded at least 25 others in the northern Nigerian city of Potiskum. Local police say the bomber detonated a car filled with explosives at a bus station early Sunday. No immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion does fall on Boko Haram, which often targets bus stations and other public gathering spots.
Somalia's prime minister has dissolved his 60-man cabinet on the day it was to face a confidence vote in the federal parliament. The prime minister has 14 days to propose a new cabinet and seek a confidence vote in the divided parliament. Abdulaziz Bello reports on the latest political developments in Somalia.
Somalia parliament members voiced strong opposition to the cabinet proposed by Somali Prime Minister Omar Abdirashid Ali Sharmake, and he withdrew his list of 60 appointees just hours before a confidence vote in the country's top lawmaking body. The Prime Minister also called for parliament to grant him a 14-day extension to form an administration. Through his spokesman, Mr. Sharmake thanked the 275-member parliament for heeding his request.
The Prime Minister has given enough thoughts to the issues raised by Somali lawmakers, and after careful consideration, he will announce a competent government that will have both the support of the Somali parliament and the Somali public.
Political analyst Abubakar Albedri says Mr. Sharmake is likely to face many challenges from the Somali parliament before his cabinet list is endorsed.
The prime minister is facing a daunting task. He is faced with dealing with a divided parliament and strong opposition of his cabinet appointees by several clans. MPs and clan elders have also voiced concern over the recent appointments, and this might derail the prime minister from delivering on his duties.
Among the problems that lawmakers had with Mr. Sharmake's list was the inclusion of former ministers and senior officials previously accused of incompetency. Experts say parliament's decision to reject the appointees indicates the maturity of Somalia's democratic institutions.
The parliament in this case has shown its credibility by turning down the cabinet appointees even before it was brought to parliament. This shows that if the administration does not cooperate with the parliament, endorsing the future government lists might prove more complicated in the future.
The East African nation has taken steps towards order after years of lawlessness, but a political crisis developed late last year when President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud forced the resignation of the then Prime Minister Abdiweli Sheikh Ahmed. The political instability is threatening the country's plan for elections in 2016. The international community remains committed to stabilizing Somalia, but United Nations and U.S. officials have demanded the country's leaders halt their chronic infighting for the sake of Somalia's future. Abdulaziz Bilon for VOA News, Mogadishu.
From the Voice of America in Washington, this is International Edition. Recent terrorist attacks in Paris have dominated political rhetoric worldwide over this past week. U.S. President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron discussed cooperation against the growing terrorist threat by radicalized Islamists during a meeting in Washington Friday. While police in several European countries conducted raids on suspected terrorist cells, groups of Muslims in a number of countries held rallies protesting against what they see as insults and assaults against Islam. Shalada Kahok has more.
European countries have boosted security in the wake of Paris terrorist attacks. The head of the European Union police agency, Europol, said international cooperation is essential as extremists move across borders and use increasingly sophisticated methods. He said a great number of European Muslims have become radicalized and armed.
We're also concerned about the way in which terrorist networks are using the internet in a much more sophisticated way, as a recruitment tool, as a propaganda tool, as we have seen with IS in Syria. But we're particularly concerned about the way in which the internet, of course, can be used for effective, secure communications outside perhaps the reach of law enforcement.
In Washington Friday, President Obama and Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron agreed to expand cooperation on fighting terrorism.
We both recognize that intelligence and military force alone is not going to solve this problem, so we're also going to keep working together on strategies to counter violent extremism that radicalizes, recruits, and mobilizes people, especially young people, to engage in terrorism. And local communities, families, neighbors, faith leaders have a vital role to play in that effort.
Ahead of the meeting, Prime Minister Cameron told the Associated Press he would seek cooperation with large technology firms to allow governments access to highly suspicious encrypted communications.
There is a broad agreement that we need to have the powers to, in extremis, intercept communications between terrorists. That is what America does today. It is what Britain does today. We share the intelligence and information between us. And this has saved countless lives, not just in Britain and America, but in other countries as well.
Meanwhile, in Ghana, President John Mahama called on African nations to work together to rid the continent permanently of the threat of terror.
I am, through the president of ECOWAS, requesting a special session at the upcoming 24th African Union Summit in order to discuss and plan, not as separate sub-regions, but as one united continent, the way forward in our collective fight against terrorism.
The week after the attacks on the French magazine Charlie Hebdo, the satirical weekly published a new issue with the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad on its cover, sparking several protests around the world, some of which turned violent. Zlatica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Secret Service says multiple gunshots were fired from a vehicle passing near the Delaware home of U.S. Vice President Joe Biden late Saturday. The shots were fired from a public road outside of his home's security perimeter. Officials say the incident took place at about 8:25 p.m. local time from a vehicle traveling at a high rate of speed. About 30 minutes later, an individual in a vehicle was arrested after attempting to pass a county police officer securing the perimeter. Officials say that person was not involved in the shooting. With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson. That's International Edition on VOA Global.
This is International Business News from the Voice of America. With Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. Swiss officials sought to reassure their country Sunday that a shock decision by the central bank to scrap its cap on the franc would not destabilize the economy ahead of a crucial week in which the European Central Bank could announce a massive bond-buying program. The finance minister, Eveline Widnier-Schlumpf, said that she expects the exchange rate to settle down at around 1.10 per euro, a level she believes firms in this support-oriented country should be able to withstand. The Swiss National Bank stunned markets Thursday when it abandoned its three-year-old cap on the franc of 1.20 per euro, saying that policy had become unsustainable. The move sent the franc soaring, prompting firms across Switzerland to warn of a plunge in profits, with the luxury, industrial, and tourism sectors most exposed.
The central bank in Greece has moved to protect its banks from any fallout from the coming general election, asking the European Central Bank to approve a standby domestic emergency funding line, according to a Bank of Greece official. That move comes after two major banks applied to be able to tap an emergency liquidity assistance window on Friday, as Greeks withdrew cash before the snap election on January 25th. Greece's radical left-wing Syriza party is leading in the polls. It wants to end austerity and renegotiate debt with its European partners.
The governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, is expected to announce his in the State of the State address on Wednesday that he will lead a trade mission to Cuba in the coming months, according to a person familiar with his plans. Trip by the second-term Democratic governor would be among the first by a high-profile U.S. politician since the Obama administration loosened travel and trade rules for the country.
That's a look at business on VOA Global.
Are you ready for a visit to the American Cafe?
I am indeed, well, as always at this time.
Well, we have kind of opposites coming up. The most populous city in the country, New York, dealing with transportation, and also one of the most scantily populated, shall I say that, the town in Kansas, about what they're doing toward their situation with not enough water to sustain their agriculture. All that coming up now on VOA. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. A record number of Americans are moving into cities and, at the same time, curbing their driving habits. No better example than New York City. VOA's Bernard Chessman visits the cafe with the story.
3.4 billion riders on New York City subways and buses a year. This amazing number equals one-third of all mass transit trips in the United States. Ridership is at its highest in almost 60 years in almost every American city. A commuter advocacy group, Straphanger's Campaign, attributes it to younger Americans, says Gene Rushinoff.
Millennials, those people born around the turn of this past century, are much less car-oriented.
In addition to millennials, many people believe public transit is economical and eco-friendly. In 2012, across America, people took 10.7 billion trips. New York is not standing still, as passenger demand requires several major expansion projects. A new $4.5 billion subway line on New York's 2nd Avenue will take an overload of passengers off of other subway lines. Its first phase completion is scheduled in 2016. And probably the most controversial and costly project is a $7 billion tunnel connection from Long Island into Manhattan's Grand Central Terminal. Trains from there will have access to New York's Midtown Business District. Andrew Albert, a board member of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, says there are many other reasons the public is riding in increasing numbers.
The system has gotten a lot more dependable. We have new cars. We have countdown clocks to tell you when the next trains are coming. We have expanded facilities in places.
New York's 24-hour, 7-day-a-week transit system costs $1.5 billion a year to maintain. It is one of the world's oldest, with its first subway line having opened in 1904. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, New York.
We go from the most populous city in the United States, New York, to one of its least populated, a farming community in western Kansas. Young people have been leaving areas like this as the business of the area, agriculture, dries up along with a diminishing supply of what is the lifeblood of farming, water. Kane Farabaugh visited Colby, Kansas.
Mitchell Ballman's farm outside Hoxie, Kansas, is about as rural as you can get.
Kind of out here by ourselves, you know, not a lot of populace.
And not a lot of rain due to a prolonged drought.
We're the eternal optimist of farmers out here in western Kansas, so we always think it's going to get better.
Ballman farms land that has been in his family for four generations. His father was born during the infamous Dust Bowl in the 1930s, when the farmland dried out, dusted up, and drove people away. But what makes the current drought different from the Dust Bowl at the Ballman family farm is the Ogallala Aquifer. Out in the heart of his wheat fields, an industrial pump draws water out of a well tapped into the massive underground aquifer. The water reaches an above-ground pivot system that slowly moves in a circular pattern over the planted crops. Ballman says it is a major improvement over the old pipe systems that used to flood the farmland.
10 years ago, we might have averaged 700 to 800 gallon per minute wells. Today, we're probably averaging 400.
Ballman is proud of those figures. He is keenly aware that the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer could could ultimately drive his family off the land.
I started realizing the importance of water when I realized that my boys and everybody else's kids want to move back to these small towns. So to keep bringing the populace back to our small communities, we have to have the water.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Colby, Kansas.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Come on in every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Author and feminist Vera Brittain's memoir of love and loss during World War I, Testament of Youth, comes to the screen with Swedish actress Alicia Vikander and Game of Thrones star Kit Harington in the leads. The story, based on Brittain's best-selling book of the same title, tells how Vera, her brother Edward, and his friends Roland Lytton and Victor Richardson enjoy one last summer together before all are pulled into the Great War. One by one, the characters meet with tragedy. Brittain's fiancé, wartime poet Roland Lytton, played by Kit Harington, and their two friends are killed. Vera Brittain, who had aspired to be a writer and had been accepted to studies at Oxford, becomes a battlefield nurse's aide and serves in several of the theaters of war. Vera Brittain's daughter, Shirley Williams, is now a liberal member of Britain's upper house of parliament. She told the Associated Press that her mother felt compelled to trade the safety of Oxford studies for the hardships of war.
My mother, therefore, decided after about 6 months that she simply couldn't bear to be in a kind of ivory tower studying, and decided that she had to get as close as she possibly could to the front and the things that they were going through. And that meant that she volunteered to work as what was called a voluntary aid detachment nurse. We'd nowadays call it an assistant health worker, probably, but they were called assistant nurses at that time.
Shirley Williams says that working as a nurse's aide helped her mother cope with the devastating pain she endured.
I think in a way that she saw working in hospital as a kind of cauterizing of the agony. She was so numbed by the work she did, the hours she did, the endless awfulness of dealing with things like gangrene, gassing, floods of casualties lying on the floor among the blood. In a way, I think it made it possible for her to continue. Because she thought of nothing but work, she devoted herself to nothing but work, and it was a kind of anesthetic, a strange kind.
Alicia Vikander, who plays Vera in the film, says that the shooting schedule was a grueling one, and she relied very heavily on her ensemble castmates to get through it.
I wanted to, make justice to this woman, and it is a lot of emotional scenes. But I had all Taryn and Kit and Colin and Dominic and Emily and, of course, James, the director, and they were such a great support throughout the film. And, yeah, we made it.
Director James Kent says that Vikander brought exactly what he was looking for to the role, vulnerability and strength that Vera Brittain had modeled in life.
You know, she has great luminosity in her face. She has great emotional intuition. And at the same time, she's incredibly beautiful. And you just want to watch her and her reactions. Incredibly subtle. Maybe that's the Swedish side of her. She brings this quite nuanced acting style, but a bit like Ingrid Bergman. You know, there's something just gorgeousness about her. And I think, she makes Vera her own.
Kit Harington told the AP that it was important to show how the war affected not only the troops on the front, but also those on the home side.
And that's what Vera Brittain's book, it helps us see more than anything else, is that side of the war. It's those women who lost all of their brothers and their loved ones and their fathers. And it's about the people left behind, really. And actually, in this film, we only go to the trenches in flashbacks or in little pieces of memory. We don't spend much time at the front.
Vera Brittain eventually went on to write two more autobiographies, Testament of Friendship and Testament of Experience. She married in 1925 and had two children. She also became known for her pacifism and her feminism. Testament of Youth also stars Welsh actor Taron Egerton as Vera's brother Edward Brittain, veteran actor Dominic West as her father, and Emily Watson as her mother. Testament of Youth was filmed on location in England and was released in Britain in mid-January. So, what do you think? Do you plan to see Testament of Youth? Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
While you're busy telling David Byrd what you think, why don't you also ask for a 2015 VOA calendar? It's really easy.
What do you think about that?
Yeah. That's a good idea. I think you should have it.
Yeah, we might miss January. You know, it takes a little while to get to you, but you can get it.
You might not have Miss January, but you'll have Miss February, Miss March. No.
If you like rock formations in the American Southwest.
That's right.
And they're gorgeous. They're beautiful pictures.
Send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com, and include your postal mailing address.
That's the sound we make when we're ready to tell you about sports.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the sound, and our Pavlovian response is to read sports to you. France's Gary Stahl dispatched the final round 65 to snatch an unlikely victory at the Abu Dhabi HSBC Golf Championship Sunday in Abu Dhabi. Nick Dye has the story from the course.
Stahl finds it hard to believe he's won, though he arrived in good form after a top-five finish in South Africa and he'd played well all week. He fired birdie after birdie in an aggressive yet controlled performance, but an early glance at a leaderboard had seen Keimer moving to 23 under par. The US Open champion was six clear at the start of the final day. He'd won in Abu Dhabi on three occasions. He was bound to win again. And yet a double bogey at 9 was followed by a triple at 13. Suddenly, Stahl led and the race was wide open. McIlroy's closing 66 meant runner-up for the fourth time in the event. Keimer was in shock, back in third. Stahl looked shell-shocked himself with all the sudden attention at winning such a big title against a star-studded field. From world number 357, he'll see plenty of doors opening now. He's in the top 100.
Australian golfer Robert Allenby, meanwhile, was recovering Saturday from facial injuries after he was kidnapped, beaten, robbed, and dumped in a park in Honolulu. The 43-year-old Allenby was in Hawaii to compete in the Sony Open at the Wailea Country Club in Honolulu. He missed the cut and was planning to fly home Saturday, according to the Golf Channel.
American Lindsey Vonn equaled Austrian Anna Maria Moser-Proel's 35-year-old record of 62 women's alpine skiing World Cup victories when she won a downhill in Cortina d'Ampezzo on Sunday. The four-time World Cup overall winner and 2010 Olympic champion, who returned to action this season after a year out due to knee operations, can now break the record in Monday's Super G in the same Italian resort.
Novak Djokovic pronounced himself fit and raring to go in search of his fifth Australian Open title Sunday after he overcame a bout of illness that had prompted social media users to suggest he was in doubt for the tournament. Djokovic had canceled a practice session and a news conference on Saturday. That's sports on VOA Global.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Most robots being used today to perform various tasks, even very simple functions, require extensive and detailed programming by humans, something that can be a long and arduous process. But Dr. Yana Solimanos, along with his colleagues at the University of Maryland Institute for Advanced Computer Studies, have been developing robots that can teach themselves various kitchen skills simply by having them watch cooking videos on YouTube. The concept that you and your colleagues have been working on seems to skip these traditional programming steps and instead are actually teaching, as you could humans, to perform functions.
Exactly. By having the robot looking at humans performing an action, if you have the right formulation, you can get the robot to learn those particular actions and to do it itself.
Along with mechanical functions to do the actual work, there is also the robot's brain, which is usually some type of computer. Using teaching methods, however, the robot needs to be able to see and hear and also be able to comprehend and replicate human-type functions. Now, how are these robots that you and your colleagues working on equipped to be able to do this?
Actually, this is what we mostly work on. We work on the brain of the computer and on the vision of the robot. Because, as you well know, and you have seen, Many people have made robots that can pick up something and move it or perform some kind of a task. What we did is we managed to piece together all these different atomic movements into actions that make sense. So in order to do that, the robot has to be able to see the hands of the person, track the hands of the person, understand the tools that the hands are holding, understand the relationship between the tools and the objects, and recognize the consequences of actions.
So why are you using YouTube videos to do this, which vary from those that are well written and produced to those that have bad audio video quality and may be poorly produced, to teach these robots and not specifically produced videos that could provide much more detailed instructions?
We could do that. However, the ability to have a robot go into the internet and, you know, look at a number of videos and understand the actions opens new horizons in our field, because you can imagine robots taking advantage of the internet and what exists in there as a knowledge base which they can use in order to learn how to perform actions. And in our experiments, we used cooking videos. Cooking is an example, because cooking is as hard as anything that you can do with your hands. So we used cooking videos from YouTube. So as a result, then, if the robot is looking at cooking videos, it's learning how to do the same actions, which amount to cooking.
What kind of progress has your team made so far? What can your robots actually do right now?
Oh, our robots can learn a number of actions that involve tools and objects, but the relationship should not be too complex. So in other words, in the way computer science is phrasing this, the grammar, so to speak, that we built for the actions, they are context-free. While there may be actions that are depending on context, or what we call context-sensitive. So for the most part, the robots can perform actions that involve objects and effect of tools on those objects, like cutting or putting together, assembling or moving things.
And finally, Professor, how close are we to having intelligent robots helping us in our kitchens cooking our meals?
We are actually very close. As far as having robots in our kitchens cooking our meals, that will take a little longer, I suspect. But we are much closer to intelligent robots that will be working and helping humans in the new smart manufacturing environments of the immediate future.
That was Dr. Yannis Alimonos from the University of Maryland Institute for Advanced Computer Studies in College Park, Maryland. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. Please visit us on the internet at voanews.com/science.
So here's a joke, not really a joke. A guy is delivering pizza.
Mm.
It's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, college town, great college town in Michigan, where University of Michigan is. There is a meeting of real estate agents, people who make a lot of money for the most part. They surprised this pizza delivery guy. He delivered one pizza to them, and they gave him a tip for $2,084.
How did they decide the $84?
It was probably the change from the pizza. Maybe they gave him a $3,000 bill. The delivery guy, Rob, said, all I did was deliver pizza. Well, the agents from the realtor company all pitched in while attending the company's regional conference, said they wanted to show their appreciation to someone from the service industry.
Hey, he also got a Visa gift card, lottery tickets, and even letters of encouragement. Now, there's something you can bank on.
Go deliver your pizza. No, it's a nice thing they did.
It is.
Then I don't know if we told you this story or not, but there was there's a sheriff's department in Pinellas County, Florida, and they had a rug made for their police station, and it was supposed to say "In God We Trust,"
mm-hmm.
but somebody messed up, and it came out in "Dog We Trust."
Hey, that's kind of cool.
It is. So you know what they're going to do?
What?
Why don't you tell me? It's a green rug.
You're asking me. What are they doing?
They're going to auction it off. Okay. And they're giving the money to a local animal rights group called Canine Estates. So, again, somebody doing the right
thing.
Very
appropriate. Very nice.
That'll wrap it up for this Monday edition of VOA Global. Let's see. Carl Starling is pushing the buttons. Diane Gao is standing there with her arms folded. She's the boss.
Managing editor.
Yeah, and Tracy Carter is ordering us around.
Pro
have yourself a wonderful day.
Bye.